This is just kind of a last minute thing. I've been in some arguments with people lately about masks, but of course my concern isn't masks per se. It's about these larger things that are happening in society around governance and around policing and around what they call the fourth industrial revolution. And so I wanted to reach out to someone who I've respected for a long time, and I've been following his work for quite a while. His name is Mark Crispin Miller. He's a professor out of NYU, and I actually recorded this a little bit earlier in the day. So I'm just going to go ahead and run the interview, and then I'll jump on afterward and make a few comments. It's about an hour long, so thank you for joining me. And feel free to make comments. I'm going to be watching with you, so I can chime in while we're watching it together. Thanks again.
So it's there is absolutely no way you can dismiss it as the work of an anti-Semite or a self-hating Jew, you know.
Yeah,
But
I don't know. They're pretty clever.
they can say anything they want. But it came out in the 60s. You could
Edit it for time or whatever, but. Yeah, so that was the main reason why I wanted to talk, but we can veer off. So I'll just start by hi, my name is Jason Bosch, and I'm sitting here with I'm not sitting here. We are sitting in different parts of the world with Mark Crispin Miller, and Mark is a professor at New York University. He's a professor of media culture and communication. He's the author of several books: Boxed In, TV Culture, the books Bush Dyslexicon, Cruel and Unusual, Bush and Cheney's New World Order from 2004. I actually first learned about his latest book was in 2008, Loser Take All, about election fraud. I actually first learned about Mark from some documentaries that I showed through Argus Fest, a documentary film festival that I was running in Colorado. And he's been in several documentaries, all of which I have shown except for the last one, Consuming Images, Merchants of Cool, Orwell Rolls in His Grave, and then one's called The True Cost, which I have not actually seen that last one. And another unique thing about Mark is he's got this great series called The Forbidden Bookshelf, which I think, can you only get it on Amazon? Is that correct, Mark?
Well, no, I'm not sure if that's the only vendor, but it is an ebook series.
Okay.
Three of the titles have been published in paper editions, and those are available from Open Road Media, which is the company that does the series. The series, unfortunately, didn't continue. We've done 27 titles of books, important books that are. Have slipped out of print, and most of which were variously killed at birth. And the 27 titles—that's a considerable number—but there are so many such books that I really wish they allowed me to continue, but it didn't sell enough. So they're still making those 27 titles available, but that's the extent of it.
What's strange about that is they're digital, so it shouldn't cost them any money, right? Like, I really wanted to get a physical copy. I purchased the one on the DuPont family, and I really wanted a physical copy, and I all I could get was the digital version. What was the story behind that?
Well, the only way the series could be cost effective for them was to do it in the ebook format. It does cost some money for them to prepare them and put them up, get the covers designed and advertise them and so on. And most of the titles have new introductions, in some cases by the authors themselves. In fact, the DuPont book is an example of that. Gerard Colby wrote a new introduction. And if the authors are deceased, we get other people to write introductions, and that costs a little money. But they're very, very cost conscious. I don't begrudge them that. And I'm not surprised that it didn't do better, because if these books were killed when they first came out, there's no reason to think the media would rush to review a whole series of them now, you know? So ideally, it would have it would have been widely used in college courses and maybe some high school classes. But there seems to be a disinclination among academics to assign ebooks, oddly enough. So anyway, it is what it is, and it's important, and I would like to continue it somehow, but we'll see.
Yeah, there's some great titles in there. And also, if I'm trying to remember, but did you write the intro to Lance DeHaven Smith's book?
I didn't write the introduction. I included that in a series I edited for the University of Texas Press, and I asked Lance to write the book. I guess I should talk a little bit about that because it's relevant.
So explain who Lance DeHaven Smith is. I actually hosted an event with him, and I filmed a speaking event with him in Denver. I was one of the co-hosts, and I filmed it, and that's how I got to know about him. But you want to explain who he is, and yeah, tell that story.
Yeah, sure. I think he's retired now, but he was a professor at Florida Atlantic University. He's a professor of public policy, and a very feisty guy who often went head to head in the Florida press with Governor Jeb Bush, and edited a terrific collection of writings on the theft of the 2000 election in Florida. That's how I first became aware of his work and got to know him. Now, when my own book on the theft of the 2004 election came out in 2005, it's called Fooled Again, to my amazement, and the amazement of the publisher, Basic Books, this significant title, which is very thoroughly sourced and makes the pretty compelling case that that election was stolen and therefore should have sparked a national conversation about the urgent need to reform the US voting system. It was almost totally blacked out by the corporate media and attacked by the left press, for which I'd often written, as conspiracy theory, okay? This was really surprising to me, as well as disappointing. But as I thought about it, I found myself wondering, where did that come from, conspiracy theory? How did that become a thing? Has it always been used that way? So I didn't take long. I just did a search for the phrase in the archives of the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time magazine, and discovered that it wasn't until 1967 that the phrase started to be used, and it started to be used in the way it's still used, which is to discredit or ridicule any argument or investigation having to do with what Lance DeHaven Smith calls state crimes against democracy. So the key assassinations of the 60s, the October surprise in 1980, and 9/11, you know, any kind of inside job that in one way or another subverts democracy. Anything like that has to be dismissed as a conspiracy theory. And the reason why I put it in that way, has to be dismissed, is that the phrase became so current all of a sudden in 67 and then continued to be used ever more widely since then, is that the CIA early in the year sent a memo to all its station chiefs worldwide. It's memo 1035-960, basically instructing them to discredit the work of these writers like Mark Lane and others who were questioning the Warren Report narrative about JFK's murder in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And you know, the memo is fascinating, and it offers four or five what we would call talking points, some of which we still see today. Like the one that's most durable is Well, if there were a conspiracy, somebody would have talked by now. You know, that line. We hear that, and often people have talked about them. They're either assassinated or nobody will publish what they have to say. At the same time, it is entirely possible for a major project to go forward with nobody talking about it. And Lance uses as his main example the Manhattan Project, you know, which went on for years, involved 100,000 people. And nobody cracked, nobody broke, nobody talked. I mean, they were under military discipline, but then the personnel in these things often are. Well, I mentioned Lance because I learned that he had independently come to the same discovery about conspiracy theory and had written an essay on it that I saw. So I asked him to write conspiracy theory in America. I mean, there's an urgent need for a history of that meme, that phrase, and the phrase conspiracy theorist, which is even more pejorative, and which is kind of new. You know, before 67, I don't think anybody was ever accused of being a conspiracy theorist. Now it's used all the time. So he wrote the book. It is a terrific book. I'm pleased to say, you know, it still has its readers. You know, I'm not the only professor who assigns it in classes, but that's who Lance is. And that is a must read. You know, now that a conspiracy theory has sort of blossomed into a whole range of pejorative terms, like fake news or misinformation or disinformation or hoax, you know, junk science. I mean, these are all ways to discredit various lines of inquiry to make sure that people are not inclined to read them. And the whole fact-checking industry, which is supported by the likes of Bill Gates and Big Pharma and others, that whole industry is heavily dependent on that meme and its variants. You know, as are all those who try to, you know, discredit or debunk inconvenient information. They rely on the use of those pejorative terms and ridicule. You know, ad hominem attacks, ridicule. They'll often point to the source of an article, and then they'll say, "Oh, well, that's you know, that's right wing, or that's Fox, or that's whatever." You know, or on that same site there was this piece, which is, you know, reprehensible. But they never grapple with the actual content. You know, mm-hmm. Yeah. They don't do that. So, you know, whenever you come across a fact check site that appears to dispatch some troubling story or possibility, just to ask yourself as you're reading it, how much of this is substantive? You know, how much of it addresses the specifics, and how much of it is just a smoke, you know, derision, insults, appeals to authority, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've read several fact-checking articles that did nothing of the sort. It didn't, you know, the headline would claim to do something that the article does not actually do, which is to debunk what the claim is being made. But if you actually sit down and read the article, it doesn't actually line up with what the headline says in the fact-checking. It's really incredible.
Exactly right. It's exactly right. That is a tried and true tactic of disinformation. A kind of fake refutation. I mean, it was recently used against me. You know, I know we're going to talk about masks, and I should probably mention that I'm kind of under attack at NYU mm-hmm. for I teach this propaganda course almost every semester, and have for years, and it's you know, heavily enrolled, and the students praise it highly, and I'm very proud of it, because the aim there is to teach students how to perceive a propaganda drive, how to assess its claims by reviewing the evidence themselves, and then attempt to figure out what interests are behind it and to what end. Now, I don't think that propaganda is an academic subject. I don't see the point of studying it if you're only going to talk about Dr. Goebbels or the, you know, Soviets. It seems to me that the course is most meaningful if you're going to grapple with propaganda drives ongoing at the time the course is happening, or at least shortly before. And it's always challenging, you know. I mean, I tell the students right at the outset and say repeatedly throughout the term that it's not easy to do this, you know, because propaganda works best when we don't recognize it as such, and when it tells us what we want to hear, when we agree with it. I mean, anybody can point to an example of propaganda that they disagree with, right? So most liberals, progressives will point to Fox News. All right, fine. Fox News is very propagandistic. But what about the New York Times? You know, what about almost all the other media?
PBS.
PBS, NPR, they're all pumping out the same line. They're all pumping out the same lies. If you take all your news from those sources, as most, I think most academics do, you will have no way to know that it's untrue, because you have no way of knowing what's been either misreported or blacked out. And this has become an especially acute crisis at this moment, right? Even as we speak. All right. So it was September 20th. We, as an example of the kind of thing we might want to study, I invoked the mask mandates. And I had brought this up the previous week. The conversation started before the September 20th class, and I had referred the class to 8 randomized controlled studies of masks as barriers against respiratory viruses. All these studies, these are, you know, the gold standard of scientific research conducted over the last 15 years or so, all found that masks are not effective at blocking transmission of respiratory viruses. These were conducted among healthcare professionals. And I mentioned these studies and said, you know, you might want to look at these because this body of research is at odds with what we're all being told about masks, that they're essential, that you have to wear them if you care about others, you know, wearing is caring, all that stuff. I mean, it is a full-on propaganda drive, and it's accelerating at this very moment. I also told them to read studies finding that masks are effective, because there's a ton of those. They've all come gushing out, you know, since the crisis began. And I gave them some advice as to how to assess their veracity, you know. For example, what do scientists say in reviewing these articles, for example? You can often find scientific responses to these. And are they, do they validate these studies? Do they have criticisms of the methodology? Also, you want to take a look at where the study was conducted, the university it was conducted at, and see if they have contracts with Big Pharma, or if they get money from the Gates Foundation, because this would suggest a kind of conflict of interest. All right, that was my guidance. On September 20th, the difference was that a student who had missed the first week or so of class, joined the class late, was now present when I sort of resumed the conversation about the studies on masking. And she was incensed by my even mentioning them. She didn't say a word in the class, but she took to Twitter a few days later and, you know, posted a stream of really vituperative tweets demanding that NYU fire me for what she called an unhealthy amount of skepticism around health professionals, which was kind of startling because the studies were by health professionals and conducted among health professionals. But what she meant was Dr. Fauci. I mean, she's a social justice warrior, you know, BLM, smash capitalism, defund the police. So she evidently assumed that I was somehow endorsing Donald Trump, you know, because he doesn't wear a mask. I'm assuming that's what she was thinking. She demanded I be fired. And then NYU responded really by taking her side. My department chair tweeted a thanks to her and said, we as a department have made this a priority and are discussing next steps, which really took me aback. She called for my termination, right? And I didn't know what they as a department were doing because I wasn't consulted. I think I'm the senior member of that department. I've been there since 1997. So that was startling. And when I asked them, why did you post a tweet basically assuring a student who wants me fired? He said, oh, I didn't mean that. I just wanted her to feel heard. You know, that's what he said. Well, the next day, the dean of the school that I teach in, the Steinhardt School, and a doctor who advises them on COVID-19 regulations, which are draconian at NYU, emailed my students directly without putting me on copy. And, you know, starting with a kind of ritual nod to academic freedom, which of course they cherish, but then implying that I had given them dangerous misinformation and essentially telling them to read a list of studies from what they called the authoritative CDC. And there's a link in their email and you can look at these studies. And they're all, you know, they're not randomized controlled studies. They're observational studies and computer models and visualizations. I mean, they're very vague and sloppy and tentative. You know, some of them concluding face masks may help protect you, etc. The email also ended with a stern warning to them that they must, you know, wear their masks all times on campus. And I had never told them not to. In fact, I had pointedly said to them, I am not telling you not to wear a mask. There is a rule here, you know, I observe it when I'm on campus. This isn't what this is about. This is about your studying the basis for this policy and thereby taking a critical look at the propaganda over masking. That was the point. Finally, I was pressed to cancel the propaganda class next term on the pretext that it would be better for the department, that's a quote, because if I were to teach two sections of my film course, that's another subject I teach often, the high enrollments would benefit the department. The only problem with that is that the enrollments in that class are no higher than the enrollments in the propaganda course, which is always full and, you know, students are waitlisted on it. So this was clearly an attempt to rein me in. Okay, now I have not forgotten your point about how debunkers work by misrepresenting what people say. The tweets also inspired or enabled some media attacks on me by reporters who did not see any need to interview me. They just ran these hit pieces, like Gothamist ran one, and there were a few others. And there was one in City and State, which is a New York-based news site about, you know, political goings on in New York. And it said that I also think that 9/11 was an inside job, and I have compared George W. Bush to Hitler, okay? first of all, neither of those positions has anything to do with the content of my class or masks or any of that. Second of all, I have never compared George W. Bush to Hitler. Never. I mean, I've written two books on that regime and a book on their theft of the 2004 election. And I even did a show in New York City in, at the theater on West 4th Street for 6 weeks in 2004 called Patriot Act. And it was all about the, you know, Bush and so on. And I have never, would never compare him to Hitler. It's a ridiculous notion. But as you say, they throw that in to make me sound ridiculous and to make the thesis that 9/11 was not carried out by those 19 Saudi hijackers, but it involved the US government. That's something that at least half the American people believe or suspect.
Right.
And it's a perfectly respectable position. You know, there's a real empirical basis for those arguments. But by jamming that together with this ridiculous idea that Bush is Hitler, they're able to, you know, confuse the issue, and that's by design. That's a deliberate propaganda tactic.
And then people get on the defensive. You know, I've had this happen with me where I'm like, oh, but it, and other people that I know that do really great work, you know, they get into this position of having to, you know, constantly defend themselves against these spurious accusations. Right. And so it eats up time and energy, and, you know, right. There's a lot of other effects to it. So why does it matter? I mean, with the mask thing, you know, I get, well, you know, just wear the mask. Who cares? Like, it's just a mask, right? When I'm like, it's more than that. It's, you know, are we going to operate in a society grounded in reality? You know, is it just, you know, just a matter of expediency, or do we really want to, like, you know, make our decisions based on the actual facts, which means deliberation and discussion and debate and disagreement for sure. Right. But what are your thoughts on that? Like, I mean, in terms of, you know, it seems like people are so staunchly opposed to any, even just the slightest bit of questioning any of this is really astonishing to me.
It is astonishing. And I want to just put in a quick plug for this petition that's up on my behalf, and not just mine. It's a petition in defense of academic freedom and free speech, not just for me, but for all those doctors, scientists, professors, journalists, and others who over the years have been censored, you know, on all kinds of topics. As I say, it's reached a crisis now. I mean, just yesterday, there was a kind of cyber massacre of, channels on YouTube. A whole bunch of really valuable truth-seeking shows were just wiped out on the grounds that their views on COVID-19 and or vaccines are at variance with the claims of the World Health Organization. Like that's staggering. So, you know, what happened to me at NYU is not unrelated to that. And are you able to post the link for your viewers, or?
Yeah, I'll put the website up for your petition for sure.
Okay, great, thanks. All right, so the question of masking, yeah. People say, well, what's the big deal? Why don't you just wear them? Better safe than sorry. Maybe they work a little bit. Well, first of all, to stress your point, we don't base our decisions in that or any other matter on the say-so of authority and the propaganda chorus of the entire media and politicians and many celebrities who I believe have been kind of organized to participate in this by Hill and Knowlton, the gigantic PR firm. This is a form.
Real quick, I would just Hill and Knowlton is the ones that were behind the baby in the incubators that led to the Gulf War, correct?
That's right, and they worked for the tobacco industry for a long time. I mean, they are really seasoned propagandists with a tremendous amount of skill and immeasurable influence. And they are participating in this mask drive, which has all the earmarks of classic propaganda. You know, it in some ways is completely comparable to the propaganda under the Nazis, actually. And I can defend that claim, which may sound inflammatory to some people. There is no scientific or medical justification for demanding that healthy people wear masks during a pandemic. This has never happened in the history of pandemics. There were a few cities out west during the so-called Spanish flu pandemic. A few cities passed local ordinances, municipal ordinances, requiring people to wear gauze masks, okay? But the idea that whole populations of healthy people should wear masks is preposterous. First of all, because they don't do anything to slow the spread or prevent infection. And this has been proven. Now, you and I can discuss this evidence like adults. All too many chronological grown-ups of my acquaintance, highly educated, liberal people, progressives, critical of the media, etc., simply cannot allow this evidence to enter their minds. You know, they just become angry or they shut down. I mean, it is the damnedest thing. And I think it has to do with the fear of death. We can get into the deeper reasons for this resistance. But the CDC itself just quietly released a report earlier this week finding that a vast majority of new COVID-19 cases were people who always wore cloth masks, not just sometimes, but the most religious maskers tended to be more susceptible to COVID-19. I think it was 108 out of 158 subjects in this study. And this has to do with the growing evidence that masks, especially cloth masks, which most people wear. And remember, Dr. Fauci is always on camera with a cloth mask on, okay? That those masks seem to expedite infection. They don't prevent it, okay? So they don't work, first of all. But beyond that, they're positively unhealthy, all right? They cause hypoxia, which is deoxygenation, which can cause brain damage. It certainly impairs short-term memory. And here we have a mandate that includes children in school all over the country. I mean, this is grotesque, you know. They're there to learn, not to be traumatized with social distancing and compulsory mask wearing. It causes hypoxia, it causes hypercapnia, which is CO2 overload. And maybe even more important, it weakens your immune system. The lungs are an excretory organ, okay, like the bladder or the colon. The lungs naturally expel pathogens from the body, pathogens that your body wants to get rid of. If you're wearing a mask, you are breathing that stuff in again. So what we have going on now, because of this propaganda, is a kind of global medical experiment on healthy populations. As people are spending hours and hours wearing masks, even outdoors, even during exercise, right? And doctors are reporting a strange increase in bacterial pneumonia, and outbreaks of strep, you know, in schools. There's one in Michigan. Dentists are discovering all kinds of gum infections and the people are developing rashes on their faces because they're not wearing these masks the way health professionals do, you know, just for a little bit of time a day and knowing how to do it. They're wearing them all the time and they're often not clean. They often fiddle with them. So let me just say one last thing about the health effects. There's also the fact, which the police and politicians and avid maskers don't care about, that there are many, many people who have medical conditions that mean they should not wear masks. And this, the authority for this is OSHA, you know, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. This is a federal agency, one of the few honest ones, which has the job of making sure that workplaces are safe for workers. They regard mask wearing as a serious issue, because if you have asthma, if you have diabetes, if you have COPD, if you have hypertension, if you have heart disease, you should not ever be made to wear a mask. You know, you are federally exempt because of those conditions. All right? So how do these governors and mayors and Dr. Fauci and the rest of them, the World Health Organization, how is it that they all demand that everybody wear masks? That even children over the age of 2, as in many states, wear masks? This is not just ill-advised. This is downright perverse. I mean, this is so perverse that it really makes a rational person wonder if they're not trying to get people, make people sick, if they're not trying to do that. The same is the case with this big push to get people to get flu shots in advance of the second wave. There are many, many studies by now, one conducted by the Department of Defense, one in the British Medical Journal, finding that flu shots increase the risk of acute respiratory infection significantly, right? There have been some studies of how many people in Northern Italy had had flu shots, the people who got really sick. And the answer is a lot of them, maybe all of them. So this huge push to get flu shots, when it's one of the last things you should do, like this ever-tightening mask mandate, you know, which is now being pushed with extraordinary fanaticism and insistence, as the so-called pandemic, you know, sort of recedes in the rearview mirror. Now we're hearing about cases exploding. This is all the New York Times talks about, cases. There's a spike, a surge in cases. That's meaningless, okay? Because the cases they're talking about are simply people testing positive. They don't have any symptoms. And what does it mean to say they're testing positive? It means these PCR tests, which were not invented to diagnose viruses, they were invented for another purpose, happen to pick up, you know, genetic debris from, like, you had a cold 6 months ago or something like that, and you'll test positive. The level of false positives is really kind of startling. And the New York Times, of all outlets, ran a piece on August 29th saying that up to 90% of positive tests may be false positives. That's the New York Times. It didn't make a dent in their ongoing terror campaign, you know, that today's paper has alarming charts, maps of the nation with red lines all over it showing how many people have tested positive. And this is being used, you know, to reintroduce lockdown, especially in the Five Eyes, you know, the Commonwealth, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the UK, but also incrementally, like here in New York, in neighborhoods in Brooklyn and Queens. They're moving toward a new lockdown, as if the old one, the first one, wasn't catastrophic enough, you know, as if it didn't kill enough people through malnutrition and medical neglect and suicide and drug overdose and domestic violence, you know. This is not theory. This is not speculation. This is fact, you know. The UN has pointed out some of this. If there's a health catastrophe on this planet today, it is due to the criminally inappropriate response to this illness, right? Which has a survival rate of something like 99.86%.
So on that, on the survival rate, right. You know, it's interesting because the media, you know, if I ask most people that support the mask stuff and support, you know, basically buy the whole narrative 100%. You know, I've heard people say up to 30% of the people that get it die. I mean, like, people really believe that. So it's like, you know, how does that figure not enter into, you know, the numbers are, and that's even according to their numbers, which is, you know, we know there's a problem with that. Hold on one second. I just want to do something with the recording.
Yes, I believe it does. A worldometer, but one of these, or several of these official outlets. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It comes from the CDC. What am I saying? It does. Yes.
Okay. And just like the fact that the public knowledge is completely disconnected from that reality. I mean, people are acting as if they get it, they're pretty much assured to die.
Yeah, I know. It's because of the power of the media in putting that terroristic spin on the news, you know. I mean, it really is amazing to see, let me just be blunt, how moronic intelligent people can be on this subject. And I saw a friend passed on an email from a New York Times reporter whose response to Trump, you know, testing positive, was that this proves that masks work. Wait, what? How does it prove that? I mean, we don't even know that he actually had it, for one thing. But if he did have it, how does it follow that it proves that masks work? That's completely illogical. But that's how people think, you know, under the spell of the media. It's all how the headlines and the pictures hit them. The headlines and the photos and the footage, you know, the TV reporters with the masks on, you know, hunched toward the camera, and maybe a morgue truck parked out behind them, and, you know, obscure footage of crowded hospital aisles, you know, all this is, it's fear propaganda. And when people are terrified, when they are traumatized and they think they're going to die, you know, that has the effect of causing them, first of all, to seize desperately whatever official explanation they can get, because they want to know what's going on. They need that. Happened after 9/11, happened after JFK. When people are really terrified and disoriented, they want to know what's going on, what happened. Well, you know, certain interests will provide the answer. And we've been getting this answer from the media. This is, you know, an extraordinarily lethal virus. There is no remedy for it, which is a lie, because hydroxychloroquine is an extremely effective remedy, which has been, you know, confirmed and reconfirmed in countless studies by now, and in the experience of doctors and hospitals all over the country and the world. No, there's no remedy. It doesn't work. If you say hydroxychloroquine works, that means you're a Trump supporter, because he touted that drug. It's extremely contagious. It kills many of the people who catch it, etc. That's what they think. And once they think that, it's very, very difficult for them to stop thinking it, okay? Now, Ernest Becker wrote this classic book, Denial of Death, in 1973 it came out. And one of the things he demonstrates is that when people are terrified of death, you know, we repress death in our culture, as many cultures do. And, you know, that gives us a sort of an inordinate terror of death, as if it's something completely unnatural. In the grip of that terror, we tend to become more committed than ever to our preconceptions and beliefs. So if we have always believed in the benevolence of the Western medical establishment, for example, if we believe that Dr. Fauci has our best interests at heart because he's Trump's adversary, or seemingly Trump's adversary, if we believe that in the first place, the more terrified we get, the more firmly we believe it. And so if you tell them it's not that dire, it can be very serious. I'm not claiming it's a hoax. I mean, I lost a friend to it myself and nearly lost another friend to it. So I believe it exists. You know, I'm also struck by the evidence that it's not really a virus, might be something else. Whatever it is, it can be very, very dangerous. But in most cases, it is not. You know, for those under a certain age and who don't have serious comorbidities, it is comparable to seasonal flu. And this is borne out by the CDC itself. You can't tell people this. You can't tell them that asymptomatic cases are not infectious or maybe very slightly infectious. That's what the scientific studies tell us. That's what the WHO's chief epidemiologist, Maria von Kerkhove, said over the summer. The press landed on her like a ton of bricks. She qualified the statement somewhat, but not really. She ended up saying, you know, the infectivity of asymptomatic cases is very weak. All right, I have a friend who's on the faculty of the medical school. I mean, she's a scientific researcher. And she won't take her mask off. She talks about the students returning to NYU. She actually used the phrase Typhoid Marys, you know. This is all based on fantasy. But I've learned now, as you probably have, that there's no point in arguing with people who are that
committed. Rigid.
Yeah, you can't do it. There's no point in it. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of energy. You need to argue with people whose minds are open, you know. And I find that many people's minds are open. Working people, I find, have minds much more open than the minds of academics, in my experience.
I actually, that was one of the topics that I wanted to talk to you about, the role of professionals in all of this. Have you read, now I can't think of his name. Oh my gosh, I'm quoting his book all the time. The book called Disciplined Minds by Schmidt.
No, I don't know that.
Oh, it's a fantastic book. It's a look at salaried professionals. It's a long title. A look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering work that defines them. Jeff Schmidt is his name. He was the editor of Physics Today, which is a physics magazine. And then he came out with this book. And it's a really incredible book talking about what it means to be a professional, how the professional class actually has the most creative freedom in society, and they're also conditioned to be the least likely to actually use it. And all the processes that go on in what it means to be a professional, where you're supposed to not bring your own, you know, I hear about this in journalism school, whatever. You're not supposed to put your own values into this whole thing. You know, you're supposed to, you know, do your job and hear both sides and not put your own judgments or values on it. And just the role of professionals, it seems like the higher you are in academia, you know, the higher educated you are, the more professional you are, you know, you have a career, the less likely you are to learn certain truths or certain things that are actually evidence-based.
That's so true. It's true of academics. It's true of journalists, professional journalists. It's true of doctors. It's true of lawyers. You know, the percentage of each of those groups that is willing to question the prevailing narrative is a very small one. I think it's growing in medicine, for example, certainly worldwide. And, you know, I think more and more scientists who are independent of mighty financial interests are starting to wake up and becoming bolder, you know. But it's true. It is the professional class is the least open-minded, and they are the most privileged. You know, years and years ago, decades ago, in his book on the intellectuals, Noam Chomsky said that the more educated you are, the more susceptible to propaganda you are, which is, you know, one of his really valuable insights. I mean, since then, he's that's a whole separate conversation. But That's a fact. That's true. You know, especially when the propaganda is pitched towards those classes, as those legacy media we mentioned before all are. I mean, the readership of the Times and the Washington Post and the Atlantic and the people who watch the BBC, you know, that's the professional classes. And when it comes to media studies, when it comes to propaganda, the problem is compounded by the fact, and I think this is especially true of academics, but also of those other groups as well, that they think they know everything already. You know, they cannot even consider the possibility that they don't know something and that they've been misinformed and that they have believed the misinformation. That is a real blow to their narcissism, you know, because they're not supposed to be fooled. They're supposed to be well-informed. And when I was still arguing with some of them about this, or trying to, you got that sense they were really offended that I was suggesting that they maybe should look at this and maybe look at that. And, well, my chair said to me, when we had this conversation about his having tweeted his support for that student who attacked me, he said, do you think you know more than the doctors at Johns Hopkins? Right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's an appeal to authority, first of all. Second of all, the doctors at Johns Hopkins, the doctors anywhere, don't really know much about certain subjects, like vaccines, for example. They don't study vaccines. They don't study the literature on vaccines. They don't read about the adjuvants added to them. They don't read about copious evidence finding connections between certain vaccines and, you know, severe neurological disorders. I mean, it's not in their interest to study that because they're close to big pharma. And as you note, you know, they have their careers to think about. They don't want to become pariahs. They don't want to become conspiracy theorists, you know. They don't want to violate the hospital's protocols. So they go along, you know.
Well, they don't want to lose their funding if they've got grants or whatever. Yeah, and I think that's a big one.
That's a big one. And that relates directly to the so-called left press, you know. The lockdown left, as some have called them, you know, like Amy Goodman, for example. And Moon of Alabama.
I noticed that it used to be the War and Peace Report, and now she often says, you know, the COVID, I can't remember how she words it, but the COVID report or something like that. You know, it's like War and Peace. Okay, I get what's incredible.
I didn't know that because I can't stand to watch it. I just read transcripts. And it is just shocking how anybody who considers himself or herself on the left could support a policy that is destroying working people, destroying the poor. Okay, it's destroying the poor. It's wiping them out. I mean, it's having a eugenic effect.
Well, you know, one of the tactics they've used is that, oh, this disproportionately affects people of color and black people, and so then it's all of a sudden you're suddenly, you know, to pit people against, oh, you're against people of color because you're questioning this, and never mind the fact, like you said, that economically, you know, the devastation, you know, and the policies that are being put into place will do devastation on poor people and people of color.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's such a patronizing, basically racist argument. You know, if they care so much about people of color, why aren't they outraged over the fact that there has been no effort by the CDC or the media to demonstrate, to drive home the crucial importance of vitamin D? You know, vitamin D deficiency has been linked to susceptibility to COVID-19, and people of color are prone to be vitamin deficient. You know, that's just a medical fact. You know, they should be not only urged to take it, but it should be provided for free to them. Okay, I don't know if you ever saw the interview with the undercover travel nurse, Erin Olszewski. There's this great series called Perspectives on the Pandemic. I'm kind of close to the team that does these interviews. They've interviewed, you know, leading epidemiologists and ER doctors and others who, you know, have dissented from the prevailing narrative. And the most powerful of those is an interview with this amazing woman who volunteered. She's a military veteran. She works at a hospital in Florida, a hospital where they've never lost a COVID patient, by the way, where they use hydroxychloroquine and other you know, it's a cocktail including that. And they never use ventilators, you know, which have killed like 9 out of 10 of the elderly people hooked up to them. She volunteered to come to New York, you know, to the epicenter of the epicenter, as they called it, which is Elmhurst Hospital in Queens. And that's a hospital that was the scene of many, many heartrending New York Times articles, all kinds of pictures and the frontline personnel and the heroic work they're doing and the tragedies that occur there every day. Well, this woman got to Elmhurst Hospital and saw what was going on. She saw that they were basically committing murder there. They were hooking people up to ventilators who did not need to be intubated, okay? They were putting COVID patients in the same rooms with people who didn't have it. They were ignoring families' instructions on resuscitation and just not resuscitating people whose families wanted them to be resuscitated. I mean, it's one of the most shocking things I have ever seen. She put on special glasses to, you know, record what she was seeing and hearing. So it's a piece of undercover journalism, which was then, you know, smeared. She was smeared. Her report was attacked by Media Matters, you know, which is the Democratic Party connected propaganda mill. And some guy named Z-Dog MD, some comedian who, you know, pretends to know something about medicine. Just slanders, you know. But the point is, nearly all the people killed at Elmhurst Hospital are people of color, okay? They're Black people in a poor public hospital. And there was clearly a push to get rid of as many of them as possible, as quickly as possible, to free up beds for other patients, because the hospital gets Medicare money for all of those patients. It was a slaughterhouse, okay? So I have no patience with this claim that somehow if you question lockdown, you are putting the lives of Black people at risk, okay? It's the people who support the lockdowns who are guilty of endangering and ending the lives of countless people all over the world, people of color.
Another thing I find interesting is, and I've seen this before the COVID thing with the electoral thing, where it's like, it's kind of like a good cop, bad cop sort of thing. Like, depending on whether you're left or right, you know, Trump says something, so you're going to think the opposite, or vice versa. And so like the hydroxychloroquine thing, I'm like, I don't care what Trump says or doesn't says. I'm like, what is the actual evidence? You know, if this helps people or not. And I don't know either way, but like, I want it to be based on the actual evidence, not what some politician said or didn't say. You know, whether they support something or opposed to something is completely meaningless to me. It's like people think they need to take the opposite position. And I think you made a comment on Facebook about, like, you know, so the people that support, and I've repeated this because it was a really good explanation of it, but, you know, like the people that can't stand Trump and the people that love Trump are both like hanging on his every word, essentially. And like, he's dominating the narrative, you know?
Yeah. His supporters automatically believe everything he says. And his detractors automatically believe the opposite of everything he says. And both positions are brainless. They're brainless positions. What he says is irrelevant.
So as like, if you're a propagandist and you know that this is the situation, you can play things a certain way. I'm not saying this is happening, but I'm saying it's a possibility where you could say, well, we could have this person say something knowing that you're, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of thinking like almost like multi-layer chess sort of thing, you know what I mean? It sounds crazy, but, you know, I don't see the Democrats and the Republicans, I don't see this this back and forth as being two independent things fighting. I see them as a part of a whole.
I don't think there's anything crazy about that. I mean, you know, division, right? Mass division is one of the oldest imperial strategies out there, right? You don't want them at your throat. You want them at each other's throats. Mm-hmm. So you divide them. The Romans did it. The British did it. And this empire does it. And Trump has served that purpose. I mean, I happen to believe, based on my study of the forensic evidence from the swing states, that Trump didn't really win in 2016. Now, not because Hillary was popular, people hated her, but a lot of people were afraid of him. Mm-hmm. And I think it was stolen, much to his dismay. You know, I don't think he wanted to be president. You know, nobody knows this. This comes from Anthony Scaramucci, the guy who was press secretary for like 20 minutes early on. He has revealed that they didn't even have an acceptance speech written that night. Okay. I think their polling told them accurately that he was going to lose and he was going to get up bright and early the next day and start his own TV network. I think that's what he wanted, because he's, you know, huge narcissist and he's all about his image and throwing his weight around and coming off like he's a billionaire when he isn't. You know, he's not Hitler. Okay. So I think that he was installed maybe with this in mind, because he has this exquisitely divisive effect. And the so-called resistance is just as divisive as he is. So anyone who questions the lockdown, much less anyone who votes for Trump or voted for him, is a Nazi. It's as simple as that. They're Nazis. They're all Nazis. So since they don't question Trump's victory in 2016, they obviously think that the majority of the American people, or a majority, let's say, because he did lose the popular vote, something like a majority or a huge plurality of the country is Nazis, you know, Nazis, Klansmen, white supremacists. And that narrative has been pushed on us ever since the George Floyd moment. And I think it's part of, you know, it's chapter two of the COVID crisis. You know, they have fed on each other in ways we could discuss. I mean, unfortunately, I have to get off in a minute because I have to do another interview, but maybe we should tape like a final thing.
Yeah, let's tape a final thing. And if you'd love to do another one of these, I would love to talk to you more, because there's a ton of stuff that I've thought about over the years that I think I would love to pick your brain on. I mean, in terms of the propaganda, in terms of techniques that are used. But one last question on the mask thing. You know, one of the things is like, why? What's the point? What would be the point of masks? If you know, do you delve into that at all, or do you?
Yeah, I have. I think that the point of the mask orders is somewhat complex. First of all, it is training in compliance, right? You wear a mask everywhere because you're told to wear a mask. And that is a kind of preparation for getting that shot. You know, I think the shot is crucial here, because it's not really a vaccine, I don't believe. I don't think it's going to be meant to protect us from a particular pathogen. I think it's going to be meant to expedite tighter surveillance and control, although it's possible that it will contain some pathogenic material that will make us likelier to die. I mean, I've looked deeply into the eugenic tradition that Gates represents. Mm-hmm. Avowedly, I mean, he pulls his punches a little, but his commitment to population reduction is manifest. It's not a conspiracy theory, and there's a whole syndicate of interests around him that have been into that for decades, and that includes the Rockefellers, whose torch he's still carrying. You know, so I think that, you know, the masks make us more susceptible to disease. They make us more compliant. they further divide us, right? The mask issue is, you know, incredibly divisive, and now has people, you know, threatening and sometimes attacking those who aren't masked. Now, the media has reported only episodes of violence against masked people, because there are some few examples of that happening, or violence against employees of, you know, like bus drivers, or, you know, people working in Costco, asking somebody to put on a mask, and then there's a sort of violent response. A few of those cases. The media reports only those. I wrote this essay called Masking Ourselves to Death, which people can find on my website, markcrispinmiller.com. And it begins with a long overview of many, many, many cases of violence perpetrated against unmasked people all over the third world, certainly, and all over China, certainly, but all over Europe, too, and all over the United States, too. All you have to do is go out in the streets of New York City or any other big liberal city without a mask on, and you have to brace yourself for abuse. You know, people become livid. Sometimes they'll say, "I hope you die." And that's kind of sick, but that's what masking has done. It has divided people against each other. It has made people more authoritarian, right? And it is making people sicker, so that whatever hits us next, and they may be rolling it out right now, will take an even greater toll, and the panic will be that much greater, and people will think that much less. You know, this is a perilous moment, you know, in the history of democracy, certainly, but in the history of humanity, because we now have a global propaganda movement, we have a global plutocratic movement to seize all the wealth and all the power, reduce the size of the population radically, and to leave a remnant who are docile and obedient to care for the likes of Gates and Bezos and the Rockefellers and others. Ted Turner, you know, who's a rabid eugenicist.
Bloomberg.
These people who have huge estates, you know, tons of land. You know, Marx got it wrong, okay? I hate to speak heretically of his thinking, but, you know, capitalism doesn't necessarily evolve into socialism, or it does, but it's a kind of socialism that the plutocrats really like. You know, Andrew Carnegie called himself a socialist. They like that kind of tight control. They like that elimination of competition. They like that, okay? I don't think Marx ever imagined the possibility of a tiny global elite becoming so fabulously wealthy and powerful that they could actually engineer a move to neo-feudalism. You know, that's what we're witnessing now. At a certain point, it's not about the market anymore. At a certain point, it's about the final push for total power. So that I think that a full understanding of this moment and what we're facing depends less on understanding Marx than on really understanding 1984, you know, that novel, and other similar dystopian novels of the 20th century, you know. I think that there's a huge push backward going on. It'd be a kind of high-tech advanced AI-based feudal system, you know, where they have all the food, they control the food supply, you know.
The money, monetary system.
Yes, they want to move to a cashless system. So this it has to be resisted. So as daunting as it is, you know, I never want to leave people feeling despair, right? It's daunting, but despair is not an option. That feeling of despair, the feelings of grief we feel for the world that's been taken from us. These feelings have to be channeled into righteous anger. We can't let this happen. And so we have to keep telling the truth to those who will listen. I think young people listen. It's been my experience in the classroom. I mean, that student who attacked me was a real outlier. It's never happened to me before. Young people are capable of looking into other narratives. They're not intimidated by the conspiracy theory meme. You know, they don't revere the New York Times the way their elders do. So the hope lies there. The hope lies with populations in other countries where they're not just lying down, all over Europe, for example. And I think the hope also lies with the vaccine safety movement, which is a huge movement of people who have seen with their own eyes their children damaged or even killed by certain shots, and learned from that never to trust medical authority without looking into this, the issues themselves, you know.
It's the vaxxed, the people that did the
right,
the movie, the sheer number of interviews they've done with parents. And just, I'm like, if people just sat down and listened to these stories, and there are a ton of them, one after another, I don't know how anybody can walk away from this and say that this is an okay thing. You know, you're not supposed to listen to these hundreds, thousands of parents' actual stories. We're supposed to just listen to these professionals. I mean, it's completely crazy. Yeah. But right, you know, right. But thank goodness there's things like, you know, YouTube and people, you know, trying to push back on that narrative, but those spaces are closing down.
Right. So we have to find alternative platforms. You know, it's like in the Soviet days, people used samizdat, you know, to get around the official censorship. We have to come up with equivalents of that. Maybe even samizdat itself, you know, maybe actual written pieces of paper, you know, that we circulate. But that's crucial, because we can't mount any kind of resistance if we can't communicate with each other. So, well, we'll see what happens. But
so where does it stand on your employment, your job situation? Where is that at? Is that still like a process that's ongoing? Well, I'll put up the link to the petition.
No, it's. I don't think there's any risk of my being fired, at least as things stand now. And I've asked about this. I talked to the provost, who's, you know, a rational person, and there's no attempt to get rid of me. I mean, I'm tenured. It would be kind of hard. But they have made me cancel my class, and they have set a terrible precedent with the dean contacting my students and telling them what to think. You know, so as far as I'm concerned, the purpose of the petition is to fire a shot across the bow and let them know that they can't really get away with this with any professor. But again, its real purpose is to make a larger protest on behalf of all those truth tellers who've been blacked out or punished for questioning the official narrative on subject after subject.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your work, and thank you for your voice. Maybe we can do this again sometime. It was great.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. We'll definitely do it again. And thanks for having me on.
All right. Thanks, Mark. I will. I'll be in touch.
Okay. Bye bye. All right.
You have a good one. Hey, so this was, I kind of put this together very hastily, and I just wanted to get it out there because there's just for me personally, there's been some heated stuff with me around people that I know around the mask issue, and I've been desperately just trying to have a real conversation, and I've yet to been able to have a real conversation. It's just basically just a parroting of what they've heard on the media, and it's, there's not even any attempt to listen to any of the points that I have to make or look into any of the stuff that I've discovered and other people have discovered on this subject, and to see a larger picture. I mean, it's extremely myopic that people are coming at this from, as if it's only about the masks. And I was going to tell a story. Earlier this year, back in February, I had a really bad cold, like probably the worst cold I've ever had in my whole life. And a friend of mine's wife had passed away, and they had a memorial service for her. And he asked if I would come and film it. And then I was very, very sick. And I didn't want to let him down. And so I actually had a bunch of masks that I had purchased because I couldn't buy a single mask. I just bought a box of them. But I went to this event like sweaty, hot, not feeling well, doing the video filming and setting up and breaking down and all that, wearing a mask the whole time. So, I mean, because I didn't want to get anybody sick. And this is before I'd even like knew about any of these other studies saying that it's not very effective, or not effective at all actually for certain viral infections. But I mean, anyway, but the point is that I do actually, it's not about the masks. It's not about the masks for me. It's about the fact that this is being used by the most powerful people in the world to push forward a system that is anti-human rights, anti-life, and anti-human, really. And if people, won't look at what the bigger picture is, it won't, engage in it, disagree with me, have a discussion about it, but let's actually have a discussion about it, but that's not happening. And so I wanted to just put this together real quick. I am going to take some clips out of this and make a shorter piece. And I'm really grateful for Mark for, giving me his time. I've got a lot of respect for him. Like I said, I've been following him for a long time, and you should look up his work at markcrispinmiller.com. And he also has a petition there, so if you click on that, and please go sign his petition. He does great work. There are very few truth tellers in this world, and in the future, if we let happen what's happening, there's going to be a lot less truth tellers because people like me and people like Mark, and there's a lot of people, all the people that I know, they're truth tellers, are people that have a little bit of independence because they're like Mark is tenured, and I don't work for any big corporation, and I don't really, even with, the social thing, I just decided, like I'm going to pursue the truth, even if it means, everybody hating my guts or whatever. And that doesn't mean I have the truth. What I'm saying is I'm pursuing the truth as I best see it, and I'm willing to engage with people on the subject matter. But anyways, I appreciate all of you that have that I've connected with and have known also that have known for many years. And so I will put some more stuff out very soon. So this is going to be I'm going to start doing a show, and I'm going to call it If We Were Honest, because that's a thing that pops into my head a lot of times, because these discussions tend to avoid certain realities. Like, yes, like we could talk about this, but don't ignore these other things. Like Mark's talking about peer-reviewed studies. Like, why are these not part of the conversation? Okay, so with the COVID, we have this deadly disease. Why aren't we having a national conversation about health? That's not happening. And so, my whole thing, and there's a million other things, but like, what if we were honest? And that doesn't mean that, it means, having some uncomfortable thing and hearing things that don't even me, like I'm up for being challenged, and I am challenged all the time. And I have a very, I'm in a very different place than I was 20, 30 years ago. And I'm probably in a very different place in 20 or 30 years from now. So I'm gonna call the show If We Were Honest, and I'm gonna start doing interviews with people and trying to have discussions, honest discussions, and even people that I disagree with, and but something, trying to create real dialogue and discourse outside of the mainstream media narrative, and one that's respectful. And so yeah, anyways, I appreciate you all, and thank you all for joining me, and.